Den digitala utvecklingen går fort och har på många punkter medverkat till att förändra stora delar av samhället och våra liv. På kort tid har vi fått många fantastiska nya innovationer, men också många nya problem. Välkomna till Aftonbladet Kulturs specialpoddar om övervakningskapitalismen. I det här tredje avsnittet hör vi författaren själv, professor Shoshana Zuboff, som har skrivit boken Övervakningskapitalismen vid maktens nya frontlinjer. Och hon intervjuas av Aftonbladets kulturchef Karin Pettersson. Och inspelningen har gjorts i samarbete med Bokmässan i Göteborg.
Welcome everybody to this conversation, which is part of the Gothenburg Book Fair. My name is Karin Pettersson, I'm the culture editor of Aftonbladet, and it's my great honor and delight to talk to one of the, in my mind, most important thinkers of our time, Shoshana Zuboff. A very, very warm welcome to you, Professor Zuboff.
Thank you so much, Karin.
You're a professor at Harvard Business School, a social psychologist, a philosopher, and author of the book The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, which came out in 2019 in the US and will now be translated finally to Swedish and be published in Sweden in the fall. Anything you want to add to that presentation of you?
That sounds wonderful. Thank you so much.
It's a big chunk of a book with lots of important ideas in it. And I think we need to start with explaining maybe the main concept of the book. And your claim in this book is that something transformational happened in the early 21st century in the relationship, as you write, between capitalism, privacy, and human autonomy. What is this surveillance capitalism that you call it, and how does it differ maybe from just capitalism?
All right. Well, let's start with a little story. So, some of our viewers will recall that in the years 2000, 2001, there was something called the dot-com bust happening in Silicon Valley. So this was a time, you know, the late 90s, the introduction of the internet, many startups, e-commerce, a lot of excitement, a lot of money, a lot of venture capital. But suddenly things hit a wall. And there were a lot of really smart young people who had started these companies who were sitting around, you know, with their thinking caps on in their war rooms, with their feet up on the desk, trying to figure out, how do we make money? We know how to sell stuff on the internet now, but we don't know how to make money. How do we make money? And one place that this was happening was a company called Google, a little startup, very brilliant founders, Larry Page, Sergey Brin, very swanky venture capitalist investors, and what people thought of even then as the best search engine that had come along. And that was even in its very early days. So what they were confronting was they had a great search engine and a great idea, but they were not yet doing capitalism. No revenue, no profit, no growth in that sense. So here we connect with the history of capitalism. In the history of capitalism, you know, we see these eras. And essentially what's happening that's kind of defining each era and driving capitalism forward is that capitalism evolves by finding things that live outside the market economy, outside market exchange, and bringing them into the market, turning them into commodities, things that can be bought and sold. That's what a commodity is, okay? So now in the year 2000, the dawn of the digital century, this was a big question. What is there left to bring into the market and turn it into a commodity. You know, industrial capitalism had aimed at nature. So where we started with things like woods and meadows and rivers, you know, we ended up with sources of raw material, sources of energy. That's what nature became, the background for extraction that fed the industrial process for over a century. Well, now, you know, what's left? You've conquered nature, what's left? And the breakthrough answer to that question, Karen, happened at Google in the heat of financial emergency, because it was then that they discovered what was left. Sadly, what was left was us. What Larry Page understood was that devices, every internet touch point, cameras, sensors, whatever that touch point was going to be, including what we do, you know, when we sit down on a keyboard online, or now what we do with our smartphones and so on, every interface with the internet was going to be a place where people left traces of their behavior, and that these behavioral traces could be agglomerated, they could be integrated, they could be analyzed. And what he said was that every life, every aspect of human experience will become searchable, will become indexable. That was his extraordinary insight. And the way Google turned around very quickly to become not only a capitalist, but an enormously successful capitalist, was to put this new logic to work. And specifically what they did was people searched. And when people searched, there were leftover data that indicated things about their behavior. You know, not only what they searched on, which was important, but how long they spent, and, you know, and the sequences that they used, and
what time of the day, or
all kinds of patterns, what we call metadata, that could be discerned about their behavior. And they realized that these metadata, these behavioral data, that were more than what they needed to improve search itself. So this was a surplus. I call it a behavioral surplus. This whole realm of data that until then they had considered just waste material, no value, left over, digital exhaust. Now it became the place where they were going to learn about people, learn about their behavior in ways that would allow them to predict future behavior. Specifically, what they figured out was that they could start to predict what ad you would click on and whether you would click through to the website behind the ad. So suddenly, these young men who had rejected advertising as something that would denature and degrade search and the internet, they now embraced a new form of advertising where they would compute a behavioral prediction and they would sell that prediction. And it would come out of the black box of what Google called, even back then, its AI. And that founded the new markets in targeted online advertising that became what is now, you know, the more than $1 trillion company that is Google, the nearly $1 trillion company that is Facebook, and all the other big players are playing in and outside of these markets. Amazon entered the market full force a few years ago, building on its consumer business to build a surveillance capitalist business. So let me define surveillance capitalism now that we've got some touch points. Surveillance capitalism combines traditional elements of capitalism. I want everybody to know that surveillance capitalism as a term is really a technical term. It's not meant to be melodramatic. It really describes what is absolutely necessary for these businesses to make money. So on the one hand, we have traditional capitalism and all of its, you know, essential elements, revenue, profit, growth, market exchange, private property, bingo, capitalism. But it turns out that they understood right from the start that if they did this, if they took this surplus that we didn't even know we left behind, and they suddenly used it to learn all these things about us and how we were going to behave. And then, of course, they started fanning out on the internet and finding all the behavioral surplus that they could and turning it into, you know, this huge data flow that was their predictive base. Well, they understood from the start that nobody was going to be okay with that. It had to be hidden. So capitalism, yes, but surveillance capitalism, because realizing all of those traditional elements of capitalism now depends on hidden methods of observation, secret methods of observation that in ways that are engineered to bypass our awareness, these methods invade human experience, experience that until now we thought of as private. Mm. They invade our experience. They redefine our experience as free raw material for their operations of extracting behavioral data. Mm. That's the new commodity. Mm. This behavioral data then becomes the object of an extraordinary transformation, because as soon as they extract it, they turn around and redefine it as their private property, corporate assets. And it's those assets that flow through their supply chains into their computational factories, which they call AI and machine learning, and produce predictions of our behavior, which are now sold into markets that trade exclusively in human futures, just the way we have commodity markets that trade in, you know, wheat futures or oil futures or pork belly futures. Mm. We now have commodity markets that trade in human futures. So if you forget everything else that I've just said to you, you can remember this. In surveillance capitalism, personal information is the stolen treasure, and surveillance is the getaway car. That's how it works.
So I think a lot of people, when they think about this, they have a vague, or maybe now the level of knowledge is, people are becoming more and more aware of this, the like foundational mechanisms for this. But I would like you to take, if we think about this one step further, and you write about this in your book, you say the problem here, if we zoom out and think about this from a societal perspective and also from the perspective as from us as citizens, is that unequal knowledge about us produces, as you say, unequal power over us. And this creates a distance between, and I like this, the way you put it so much, it creates a distance between what we can do and what can be done to us. And one of the main points in the book is that the surveillance capitalism is not only about surveillance, but it's also, and maybe and much more dangerously, opens the road to manipulation, not only controlling people's behavior, but also actually influencing how we behave in the future. And can you talk about that mechanism and the dangers of that a bit more, sort of the next step?
So it turns out that when human life is the commodity, everything changes. So think about it this way, you know, how did things get so out of control? There are a whole bunch of reasons, and I won't go into all of them. So you can you can take a breath, a sigh of relief.
We only have half an hour.
There are at least 16 reasons that I go into in yeah, depth in the book.
I know.
And I won't do that right now.
But I recommend everybody to read the book. So read the whole thing. Yeah.
But there are a couple of reasons that are really, you know, at the very top of the list that we need to understand. One of them is that this thing is so unprecedented that, you yeah, know, if something is truly unprecedented, you can't imagine it. There are no categories in your mind to imagine something that has never happened. You know, we face this problem with climate change, with global warming. Mm. That what is happening to our earth is unprecedented. And people who understood it have been begging us, pleading with us for decades, please, please take action, understand this. But it's so unprecedented that it has really been hard for us to grasp. And so what happened? You know, it takes the extreme weather, the flooding, the wildfires, the deserts, the, you know, the rising oceans. So that only when we experience it can we finally imagine it and begin to think forward and begin to mobilize. Well, something like that has happened here. But now we're talking about not the physical earth, but actually society itself. And it turns out that when personal experience, always assumed to be private, is secretly extracted as free raw material, as the new commodity for private economic operations, everything changes. And the first thing that changes is the wholesale destruction of individual privacy. That has already occurred, and that's occurred over the past two decades as surveillance capitalism has rooted and flourished. And the second thing that was so unprecedented is that it was impossible to grasp the kind of social harms that are produced when revenues and profit depend upon making all human behavior more predictable across every kind of domain of everyday life. Whether you're walking on the street or whether you're shopping or whether you're online, you know, applying for a mortgage or whether you're looking for a place to rent or you're in your car, you're in your bedroom, wherever it is, your behavior is being captured and used in ways to make your behavior more predictable. The more they can make your behavior more predictable, the better their predictions are, the more money they make. So you put these two things together. We have no more privacy. They've come into our experience. They've taken our rights to know about our personal lives, and they've concentrated those rights in the corporate domain. So, you know, when you think about it, everybody understands we're in an information society now, but we're really in an information civilization. This is an era that, you know, is beyond just individual societies because it's across societies. We're all sharing these new conditions. And in an information civilization, you know, what is social order? How do we think about society? Well, What I would really like people to understand is that in this new world, the social order is really based on things about knowledge. And I kind of simplify this into three essential questions. And these are easy to remember. In this kind of society and civilization, we have to ask ourselves, first of all, who knows? How is knowledge distributed? Who knows? Second of all, who decides who knows? And that means who has the authority over how knowledge is distributed? And then who decides who knows? What is the source of power that backs up that authority that decides how knowledge is distributed? Well, what's happened now, Karen, is that we are in the early days of an information civilization without any protection, without any laws or rights that protect our private lives. And as a result, what has happened is that the big surveillance capitalists, these huge surveillance empires, especially the Big Five and their ecosystems, they now control the answers to every one of those questions. They have unilaterally decided who knows about us. And they've taken all of this data, these data from our lives, concentrated these information and the knowledge from it in the corporate domain, in their companies, as their private assets. And what that means is that they've taken away our decision rights. We have always assumed that we had the right to decide, you know, who knows about me? What do I decide to share? with whom and for what purpose? And therefore, what do I keep private? So while we've been thinking of privacy as like this thing in itself, it's really not. Privacy is an effect of a cause. And without those rights to know, those sovereign rights to know and control the knowledge of our own experience, I call these epistemic rights. Mm. Epistemic means everything to do about knowledge and knowing. So without those rights, you know, as belonging to us, we have no protection, because these rights, even though we assume them, we think of them as elemental, as natural, they're pre-political. They haven't yet been translated into law, you know, the way freedom of expression has been translated into law, or the right to private property has been translated into law. So so what happens now is that they have all the knowledge, they have the rights to the knowledge, and as a result, that means that we have this growing axis of inequality, where they have so much more knowledge than we have. The gap between what we know and what can be known about us is literally growing every day. And as you said, that produces power, knowledge is power, and increasingly what we see is that, what do they do with all of this knowledge? Mm. Well, they use it to target. They use it to analyze at the individual level, at the group level, and at the collective level. And they use it through those analyses to create a whole range of targeting mechanisms that use the knowledge they have about us to boomerang back to us and to trigger us in certain predictable ways that, first of all, increase our engagement, that increase our engagement in order to increase their extraction opportunities. And then with that, the more they understand us, the more they can trigger us in ways that shape and modify our behavior in line with their commercial objectives. Go here, do this, buy that, connect over here, read this, but also in the political domain. Connect with this group, go to this meeting, read this political material. And all of these targeting mechanisms are engineered not only to be invisible to us, but also to maximize our engagement so they're getting the most from us all the time. Hmm. The last point here is the unfortunate consequence is that a great deal of research has shown that what attracts the most engagement from us is actually the worst information, the most toxic, corrupt, bizarre, crazy, defactualized information is what does the best job of drawing our attention. And so that is what the machines are programmed to seek out and to amplify. Every society has crazy stuff that people say. But in a normal society, those crazy things appear at the margins and they stay at the margins. But now what's happening is that all of our interface with the internet, every single touch point, everything we do, getting our test results from the doctor's office, getting our grades from the school, our children's grades from the school, whatever we do, we are marching through these institutional mechanisms, these supply chain interfaces, and we can't escape it. So now what happens is we are everywhere we look, you know, we are exposed to these operations that are intentionally amplifying the most corrupt and toxic content that should be left at the margins, is being thrust into the center of social discourse on the internet, in social media. And that is having a huge corrupting effect on our societies that we can, of course, talk about in more depth if you choose. So the bottom line here is that surveillance capitalism, which begins with, you know, this fast track to revenue and monetization that we discussed earlier actually turns out to be something far more penetrating and consequential for society than a merely economic operation. Instead of producing economic harms, it produces social harms. And these social harms are changing our society. They're changing the distribution of knowledge, authority, and power in our society in ways that are profoundly anti-democratic. So they have the rights, we are robbed of our rights. They have the knowledge, it's taken from us, but it's not used for us. We have an expectation of greater democracy in the digital era, democratization of information, where in fact we have greater inequality and concentration of knowledge in the hands of the few instead of the democratization of knowledge in the hands of the many. And finally, this pernicious effect on our societies, which is weakening democratic institutions, making democratic discourse almost impossible in the internet domain, which of course has knock-on effects throughout our society in the real world.
So the question that arises from that description that I personally very much agree with, and I think you can observe in the political sphere in many ways, but is the question that arises is, you have these enormous entities, these companies with a massive then also lobbying power that comes with great wealth and this informational, the strength they have in that sphere. And then you have democracy. And what do you believe that the democracy, does it have the tools to fix this? Because what you're describing is this downward spiral, weakening of democracy at the same time when we need the democratic institutions or mechanisms to come in and create something new that works in the information age or in the age of surveillance capitalism. So do we have the tools, or is it too late? What do you think?
Well, I'm so glad that you asked this question, Karen, because it's it is an essential point that everybody really, really needs to understand. I'll begin by jumping to the conclusion, which is it is not too late. It's exactly the right time, and there's no time to waste.
Okay, I'm glad. I'm relieved.
That's the conclusion.
Okay,
and,
good.
Okay, so let's be really, really clear here. What I have described is a revolutionary takeover of the key dimensions of social order in our time. This revolutionary takeover, I call it an epistemic coup, a revolutionary takeover of everything that concerns knowledge and knowing. How did this revolutionary takeover occur? Well, in large part because, as we said before, we didn't see it coming. And because we didn't see it coming, we didn't do very much about it. So democracy, and people, I'm about to say democracy has been asleep at the wheel for the last 20 years. And of course, folks watching us will say, well, hey, what about GDPR and what about data protection and all of these things we've been working on? Yes, we have been working on them. It's not that, we've done absolutely nothing. But the point is that we worked on them in a way that, in my view, and my dear, dear friend, a man who I respected enormously, Giovanni Bucarelli, who was the European Data Protection Supervisor until he passed away a couple of years ago, an untimely death. And he joined me in Brussels in 2019 when this book was launched. And he was incredible because he stood in this hall full of people and he said, GDPR wasn't enough. We thought that it was going to do the trick, but in fact, we didn't adequately understand the deeper story of surveillance capitalism. And if we had, we would have seen that GDPR was only the beginning. We need to do much, much more. We need to, you know, focus on the fundamental illegitimacy of this massive scale extraction of human generated data. That is what, you know, is the sort of illicit, illegitimate bed of sand on which this whole economic edifice has been built. So ultimately, we're going to have to go after extraction in order to interrupt and outlaw these operations. But I think the key point here that's relevant to your question, Karen, is that there is a paradox. Surveillance capitalism aims to weaken democracy. Increasingly, companies are using their power and what I call epistemic dominance, kind of the most recent stage of the coup. And that is where they're really showing their willingness to go head to head with democratic governments and democratic officials over the rules and the values and even the legal principles that will dominate in a democratic society. In fact, they're showing more and more that their true objective is to substitute computational governance for democracy, for democratic governance, to substitute their information systems for our systems of rights and laws. And we see evidence of this popping out now more and more frequently as they feel more and more empowered and audacious to really intervene between citizens and their democratically elected governments. So there is a paradox. Democracy is weakened. But the paradox is, even though democracy is under siege, democracy is the only countervailing force that can meet private capital head to head and actually rein this thing in so that it delivers us to a new trajectory where we have the digital, we have the data, but now the digital technologies and the data that is useful to individuals and society and across our societies, these data now are harnessed to democratic values and aspirations and to democratic governance. So finally, we decide about our personal experience, what is shared with whom, for what purpose, what remains private. But we can certainly share, you know, for example, anonymized health data that's going to help in the cure for critical diseases. And we can share data about our life in the city that accrues to democratic affiliations and democratic institutions that live under public law. And so they're transparent and we all participate in their governance. And in this way, we can pull ourselves, in the same harness to create databases that help us improve our cities and our neighborhoods in the ways that we as citizens and residents choose through democratic processes. So the crazy thing that's happened, Karen, is that over the last 20 years, as surveillance capitalism has rooted and flourished, the liberal democracies of the world have failed to create their own vision of a democratic digital century, of a way of designing and deploying the digital that advances the democratic form of government and of values and aspirations. That failure left a void, and surveillance capitalism filled the void. And it's useful to know from a geopolitical point of view that, you know, the Chinese, for example, have acted very differently. They did create a vision, a very specific vision of how the digital could be used to advance their form of authoritarian government. And they have made that vision central to their domestic and their foreign policies. But as liberal democracies, we have failed to do something similar. Now is the time. You ask if it's too late. In my country, Karen, in the United States, when we look at this industrial capitalism, you know, the early phases of industrial civilization and industrial capitalism, the owners, the employers had all the power on the strength of their property rights. And the economic harms they produced fell on workers and consumers, but there were no workers' rights. There were no consumers' rights. In my country, those rights were not codified. Remember, we talked about epistemic rights as pre-political, not yet codified. Workers' rights and consumers' rights in my country were not codified until the fourth decade of the 20th century, the 1930s. And yet we created the charters of rights, the regulatory paradigms, the legal frameworks, and the public administrative institutions to oversee and enforce. And we did it successfully. And ultimately, we tethered industrial capitalism to democracy in a way, both in North America and in Europe, that allowed a relative equilibrium, that allowed ultimately a middle class to grow and to flourish, and many other public goods as a result of this equilibrium. That is the work that confronts us now. Only politics can achieve this work. Everyone has to be mobilized. Everyone has to join this effort. This is the critical work for lovers of democracy, for warriors for democracy in our era, to now create the new charters of rights, the new regulatory paradigms, and the new laws and institutions that protect us and promote democratic life, democratic communities, democratic governance in the digital century. That's the challenge. We are just at the very beginning now of the third decade of this digital century. And it is my view that this decade, Karen, is absolutely essential. We've got to turn the trajectory, first of all, away from the iceberg of the autocracy of surveillance capitalism, and now back toward democratic governance. And once we do that, and by the way, this is an operation that is already underway, both in Europe and in North America. Once we do that, we begin to lay out the rights and the laws and create the institutions that will keep us safe. That is the work of this decade. As I said before, we have no moments to spare, because if we wait another decade, this effort will become infinitely more difficult than it is right now.
Thank you, Professor Zuboff. I wish we could talk about this for hours, and I find your work, as I said, extremely fascinating. And this book, I wish everybody would read it. I'm very happy it's coming out in Swedish now. And I'm so sorry that we have to end it here, because there's so much to talk about. But thank you so much for your time, and really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Karen.
Du har lyssnat på en podcast från Aftonbladet. Ansvarig utgivare är Lena K. Samuelsson.